AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, broadcasting live from the Rudy Luther Toyota Studios at AM 950. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Dr. Greg D'Onofrio is the Associate Professor, Director of the Heritage Studies and Public History Program at the School of Architecture, the College of Design at the University of Minnesota. He also was a senior consultant on the current exhibit over at the Hennepin History Museum, Human Toll, which talks about the sacrifices made for the building of interstate highways. He's kind enough to join us today to talk about that new exhibit and his research as he has been working on this project for a while. Greg, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
Well, it's I find it to be now I'm a history guy. I like history myself. I also love maps, and I love to see how cities grew and everything. And one of the things I think has been very interesting is we have started going back and looking at the building of the interstate system, not just here in Minneapolis, but nationwide, and realizing there was an insane amount of injustice for a lot of the communities that were basically wiped out with the building of these interstates.
You're absolutely right. One of the things we seek to demonstrate in this exhibit, in the early part of the exhibit, is that what you see in South Minneapolis and in places like Rondo and St. Paul is a pattern that is seen throughout the country, as you've suggested, that interstate highways, if you plot the locations of black communities in cities large and small across the United States, the interstate highway system was run through them or directly along the edges of them. And it happens almost everywhere there is an interstate highway that runs through a city or town.
You know, we've talked in the cities here a lot about the Rondo neighborhood, 94, over in the St. Paul side in the Midway, that was wiped out by the construction there. We haven't talked that much about the 35W building. Well, let's start off by talking about what did the city look like prior to 35W being built? What were the neighborhoods like south in South Minneapolis?
Well, the neighborhoods were dense residential fabric, just as they are today, of single-family homes predominantly, but also apartment buildings, and there were some businesses that were disrupted and displaced by 35W. It was also, you read a lot about this, before the construction of 35W, a city preoccupied with traffic and traffic congestion. It's interesting to wonder if traffic was bad sort of by their standards in the mid-1950s, or would we consider it bad traffic today is subject to interpretation, and we weren't able to figure that out ourselves. But people describe it before the construction of the freeway as a really interconnected community. And in particular, our exhibit takes a close look at the Southside neighborhood. That was an integrated community that had a large population of middle-class African-Americans. And there is a discussion among black elders in South Minneapolis that 35W felt like, to them, a racial dividing line that was very purposely located.
It sounds like when they were getting ready to build this, from just some of the stuff I've read about it, is that the city of Minneapolis seemed to go out of their way to not let the residents know what was coming.
Well, the reality was that the Interstate and Defense Highways Act of 1956 required one public meeting for every project that was proposed in any place. And that's what freeway planners did. So there was one public hearing held to inform the public about 35W, and there was one public meeting held to inform the public about Interstate 94 in Minneapolis. And it really was designed to be informational. These were not, let's say, genuine attempts to solicit community feedback and concerns. These were opportunities for highway planners to tell the public what was going to happen. I think there were good faith attempts to inform the public of the interstate highway building process in Minneapolis. A question we might ask is, how was the public informed, and was it likely to have reached the entire community? Because, we don't all receive information in the same ways then or now.
I was reading an article about you from last year, and you talked about the notice they put in the Minneapolis Star at that point was buried. that they it was kind of one of those things where you really had to go look for it to find that where even the public hearing was going to take place, the one public hearing about it. And, you know, because of this, it did seem like there was a bit of outrage in the community and petitions and people, you know, protesting that this, you know, there should be more input here from the local community.
Well, it's interesting. You're absolutely right. The public notice that again, was placed not by the city of Minneapolis, but by the Minnesota Department of Highways, was a legalistic public notice that was designed to fulfill a legal obligation. And it was sandwiched between advertisements for trailer homes in the back of, on page 37 of 38 of the Minneapolis Star. It's one of our findings in this project is a bit of a surprise that there was not as much public pushback as you would expect for a project that quite literally consumed 50 square blocks of mostly residential property in South Minneapolis. To put this in perspective, interstate highway construction in Minneapolis, the construction of 94 and 35W, displaced an estimated 24,000 people. That is one in every 20 residents in Minneapolis at that time. And yet, some newspaper reports that there were about 300 people that attended this public meeting, and there is a full transcript of this meeting that happened in March of 1957. Only 16 people stood up to provide testimony, and some of those people were in support of the project.
At this point in 57, describe how far south did the city really go at that point?
Well, the suburbs were just beginning to expand into what we would now know as Edina and Richfield, but you know, it was really just at the beginning phases. And to be clear, the construction of the interstate highway system in 35 and 94 very much enabled and supported that suburbanization process. But, of course, not everyone had access to living in the suburbs. African Americans and other BIPOC communities were largely shut out of buying and building homes in the suburbs due to a number of racist policies and practices.
And this was a continuation. When you look at these maps where the interstates were built, it was really a continuation of longstanding racial policy, the redlining from the banks where they basically went through. I mean, it does seem like it did follow that pretty cleanly, didn't it?
It really did. You know, we spent 2 years looking, in a sense, for a kind of smoking gun that would demonstrate that, you know, there was a kind of racist intent to the location of interstate highways in the Twin Cities. And what we find is that, you know, there isn't a smoking gun. You will not find a smoking gun. And to look for one fails to see that how structural racism works. Mm-hmm. It is literally embedded in the nature of policies and practices, large and small. And so you're right. In the exhibit, we provide evidence for a kind of racialized logic to the location of 35W, beginning with things like redlining maps created by the Federal Homeowners Loan Corporation in the 1930s, and going all the way up to freeway planning documents. You know, there are subtle hints, and we leave it to viewers of the exhibit to make their own determinations.
Greg D'Onofrio is joining us. The exhibit is called Human Toll, a public history of 35W over at the Hennepin History Museum. When the process was going on here, I also read from an article from a while back that it sounds like the city was starting to buy up properties and just leaving them vacant. And it was really kind of turning what eventually became 35W into a really, a pretty eyesore community on the south side. Is that a fair statement?
It is, though. Again, I would want to shift the responsibility of this project from the city to the state. This was very much a project of the Minnesota Department of Highways, using federal money and some state money to acquire properties through eminent domain. Now, to plan a project of this scale and magnitude and complexity, they had to purchase property several years in advance of construction beginning. And then there was a process of selling the homes and the buildings on that property for people who may seek to relocate them to other locations or to salvage them for scrap. And then buildings that weren't relocated or substantially salvaged and repurposed were demolished. But between acquisition and that ultimate demolition or moving process, there were a couple of years where, you know, according to newspaper reports and photographs, there was some, let's say, not always the most diligent maintenance for snow removal and lawn cutting and things of that nature. So there was, in a sense, a kind of blighted corridor for a period of years when 35W, before construction began.
And it should be noted, I mean, this is a huge swath, I mean, blocks of land that are taken out. I mean, if you ever get the chance to look at Larry Millett's great Then and Now book, you can see some of these areas that the interstate became where, you know, it's, you know, a vibrant neighborhood that no longer exists. One of the things, and you're right, it was a state project, but isn't that also, as you were referring to, part of the systemic racism, the fact that they prevented this from being being city decisions and kind of got it up to the state to where the state could just kind of push this through, and it didn't really matter what the local residents wanted, because they can go and complain all they want to City Hall, but the reality is by doing it through the state, it basically limited the ability for the community to fight back on this issue.
Well, at the time that 35W and 94 were being planned and property was being acquired, municipalities had to approve the locations and the routes within their borders. And so Minneapolis approved the location of 35 and 94. Something that is hard to understand from our contemporary perspective, when we went into the archives looking for evidence of resistance and protest, we didn't find much in the archives, and what we found was a lot of documentation of political figures and business owners complaining that the freeways were being built too slowly. I mean, this was the jobs program of its era. Mm-hmm. It was a huge work project where just millions of dollars were being funneled into cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul to build these roadways. And so they were really thought of as economic generators that were desperately needed. Now, when I say they were thought of this way, they were thought of this way by some large segment of the population, certainly by political leaders and business owners, but obviously not by everyone, particularly if you were losing your home.
It is interesting when you look at 35W on the south side of Minneapolis, because there are still some areas where they've had a hard time. Lake Street, you know, it doesn't help you put a Kmart in the middle of Nicollet there, but you have areas where, I mean, it's starting to come back. I would say that it looks more. I was just down there this last week, and it's more lively than it's been in a while with the brand new reopening of the remodeled 35W. But you know, it's a far cry still from if you go down to 50th. I mean, it's the streets on both sides of the highway there are relatively well-to-do, very, you know, acclimated to their location at this point. When you look at the impact of the 35W, how do you feel the individual neighborhoods along the line? Why do you feel it's been difficult for some of them to come back at this point? Is it still just the systemic racism at that time just built up a system where there was just going to be almost impossible to bring it back to a more viable community setting in the future?
Well, the exhibit pays particular attention to what was, by many, many accounts, a thriving and integrated community that was centered around 38th and 4th Avenue, and widely referred to as the Old South Side. And this was a neighborhood of residences, but also a business district as well. And the city of Minneapolis has recently declared this as a cultural corridor that it seeks to revitalize in collaboration with the community and to highlight the long African-American tenure and culture in that neighborhood. But it's true to say, to your point, that communities had different abilities to bounce back from an impact like 35W. If you had more resources, you could relocate elsewhere in the city. You could you could weather a kind of economic and social impact like 35W in your neighborhood. But other communities had less resources. And, you know, a lot of things are going on in this post-war period. clearly construction of the interstate highway system, but also the suburbanization of retail is happening with the construction of things like Southdale Mall and other shopping malls and strip malls and corporate office parks that are being built in the suburbs as well. So there were a lot of trends and forces and construction projects that, when all totaled up, were driving economic activity and people into the suburbs. So it's hard to identify one thing that had a really terrible impact on a certain neighborhood. But there were several things, and many of them were supported and condoned and financed by the state and federal government.
I'm going to ask you a question, which is this is the hard one. We have a history in this country of this sort of thing happening. The interstate system is just another one of the latest examples, but yet it still seems like we as a society don't learn the lessons from these cases. I'll give you a prime example. Line 3, the pipeline up in northern Minnesota that's going through Native American territory. They do not want it there, and no one seems to care. And I guarantee you in 20, 30 years, there'll be, there might be another exhibit, about how the people were completely ignored on this project, and they probably shouldn't have been. And so how do we change, do you feel? What's the best route for us to change to stop this level of injustice from happening, whether it's an interstate system, a pipeline, or other infrastructure development?
It's a great question. And one of the things that was so interesting to me and I didn't expect at the opening of the exhibit this past weekend on Saturday at Hennepin History Museum is many people made this association to Line 3 and are essentially making the point that you're making. You know, one answer I would give to this is I think representation really matters. Many branches of government and businesses are seeking to diversify their workforces to bring different perspectives to their staffs. And this is true of elected government as well. I think when you have BIPOC people in these positions who can speak to and represent their communities, and people who look like them, and understand those particular needs and concerns, then decisions will be made differently. I truly believe that. But this is not going to happen quickly. Even though I think it should and more ought to be done to bring diversify our workforces. But I think it's going to make a difference over the long term.
Human Toll, a public history of 35W. It is over at the Hennepin History Museum, 2303 3rd Avenue South. It's right by the MIA. And once again, some great news here. North Bay Companies, because of their great support, the mission is free for all through the end of the year. Very a wonderful opportunity for you to go and see this and learn a little bit about the history of the interstate system and the injustice that went along with it. Once again, Greg D'Onofrio, Associate Professor, Director of the Heritage Studies and Public History Program at the School of Architecture, College of Design at the University of Minnesota, as well as also a senior consultant on this museum exhibit. Greg, thank you very much. A fantastic exhibit and all my best. I really appreciate the time today.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed the conversation.
We'll take a break. Come on back. Wrap up the first hour. When we do return, it is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.